So much. Nice to see you all here. What I'm going to try to do is give a little bit of an overview about some of what healthcare reform is doing with regard to the safety net, and then two other speakers I think will be able to dig more deeply into some of the issues that I bring up. So first, talking about what the healthcare safety net is, the Institute of Medicine a few years ago put out a very valuable report in which they identified and sort of defined the safety net as those providers that organize and deliver a significant level of health care and other health-related services to the uninsured, Medicaid, and vulnerable patients. I think many of you and people who have interests in the healthcare safety net have a good ability to sort of recognize what the special characteristics of these institutions are. But it really, in many cases, boils down to some of the issues related to the kinds of patients who come to these entities. And there are several factors that will influence within a community. There's tremendous local variation in the healthcare safety net, and there are things in different communities that will affect the need for safety net providers. One of which historically has been the rate of employer-sponsored health insurance, and therefore the degree to which there are people not covered by insurance through that mechanism, which is clearly the most significant in how we provide insurance in this country. Medicaid eligibility rules, so how states vary in how generous or more limited they are in making Medicaid eligibility available for their populations. What the participation rate is of private providers in the care of the uninsured and Medicaid also varies tremendously across different communities and will affect the demands, therefore, that are left on safety net providers. And then undocumented immigrants, and this group particularly has been a group that has had difficulty, of course, accessing private health insurance. Healthcare reform did a lot to change the environment and the way that we will think about the safety net in the years ahead. Some of these things will be starting to be implemented sooner, and probably the most significant change, as you probably have come to know, is going to happen in 2014, when there'll be a very large expansion of health insurance coverage. Some of the other things that I want to highlight for you today, though, also related to healthcare reform that I think will be influential in the safety net, are temporary increases in Medicaid primary care physician payments that begin in 2013 and run for 2 years, increased funding for clinics, a safety net demonstration demo, and community-based collaborative care networks. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about each of these issues. So let's talk a little bit about the health insurance expansion. About half of the health insurance expansion is happening through the Medicaid program. There is anticipated by the Congressional Budget Office to be 16 million new beneficiaries entering into the Medicaid program who were previously uninsured beginning in January of 2014. And almost half of the money, so $434 of $938 billion over the 10-year window estimated by the Congressional Budget Office, will be invested in expanding coverage through the Medicaid program. So this is a very sizable and significant increase in investment, and a very large portion of what was invested in healthcare reform is going into expanding the Medicaid program. There will be a new category of in the Medicaid program, and when I identify it as a new category, in a way, what I'm really saying is there will no longer be categories in the Medicaid program. The new category is childless adults, who were overwhelmingly the largest group of people who were uninsured, who were not eligible for the Medicaid program, who were low income. And so that in many ways what the Medicaid expansion is doing is eliminating some of what historically has been there between what I would label as the worthy and the unworthy poor in the Medicaid program. And now the Medicaid program will be blind to those issues of the categorical differences and be based on income only. There will be a standardized income eligibility across all states. That eligibility income level is 133% of the federal poverty level, but there is also a 5% income disregard, so that in actuality, it'll be functionally that those who are 138% of the federal poverty level and below will be eligible for the Medicaid program. Medicaid is a very significant part of the safety net, so it's not only very important for the individuals who are uninsured who will now gain insurance, but Medicaid has historically been the main source of funding for most safety net providers. And just to highlight that, in California, if we look at clinic funding, 73% of the dollars that clinics get in the state of California is through the Medicaid program. Public hospitals, it's 63% of our funding. And while, of course, not-for-profit hospitals play some role in charity care as well, you can see that it's significantly less. Only 14% of their funding is actually driven from the Medicaid program in California. A key issue about healthcare reform is not just expanding coverage, but how coverage can ultimately be the basis of expanding access to care. And in order for coverage to expand into access to care, of course, requires that providers be open and willing to accept Medicaid as the source of insurance for people who want to seek care. Currently, only about half of physicians in the country are accepting new Medicaid patients into their practice. So this would be a significant barrier for all these people entering into the Medicaid program. The number one reason that's been identified over many years of research around this has been low payment rates. It isn't the only thing, but low payment rates to providers has been a significant barrier. And there's been a lot of work that has estimated that in the ballpark of the payment rates to physicians, for example, in the Medicaid program is about 60% of what it is in the Medicare program. And that, again, will vary from state to state. States have the ability to set their payment rates, but on average, it's about 60% of what Medicare payment rates are. And recognizing this, healthcare reform tried to really take at least a begin to change that equation. And so beginning in 2013, anticipating that it would take a little bit of a while for the message to get out to the provider community that Medicaid payment rates might begin to go up and therefore to try to encourage more providers to come into the system, the requirement by the federal government on states is that states pay at least 100% of Medicare rates for primary care services for 2013 and 14. And we can get into this, if you'd like, during the question period about why the limited time period and why only primary care providers. I'll simply say here that this was trying to get a foot in the door of trying to change the nature of getting payment rates as a mechanism to try to enhance access to care in the Medicaid program. Shifting now to the issue of clinics, which was also significantly addressed both in healthcare reform and in the stimulus bill, which was passed about a year before that. The IRS stimulus bill actually provided $2 billion in expansion funds for clinics. $1.5 billion of that was for construction and renovation, and $500 million of that was for operations. In the Affordable Care Act, $11 billion was made available for expansion, but in this case it was $1.5 billion more for construction and renovation and $9.5 billion for operations. And this is a very sizable increase on top of funds that were already available for clinics. Clinics, and I'll one of the other speakers here today will get into this more, but clinics is really one of the true issues that both sides of the aisle were enthusiastic about. And so that I think that's a very fortunate part of the healthcare reform changes is that clinics are seen as a keystone to trying to help convert coverage into access. I think there will be some fairly significant challenges for the safety net as well in relationship to healthcare reform. And probably the one that many safety net providers are already starting to worry about is, okay, so we're going to start to give many of the people who have come to our sites because of varying circumstances, health insurance coverage through Medicaid and potentially through the exchange if their income is a little bit higher to buy private health insurance. What impact will this have on where patients then choose to go to get care? And there have been other examples of this in the past where there have been changes in payment rates or eligibility for getting into insurance programs that have led to shifts of patients leaving safety net providers at various times. And so this is very significant as a challenge in a sense of whether safety net providers will be able to compete for their own traditional patients. At the same time that this is happening, safety net hospitals, which receive additional payments through DSH, the disproportionate share hospital payment mechanism, are going to see a reduction in those special earmarked funds that went to these hospitals to provide a disproportionate amount of care to Medicaid and uninsured patients. The rationale for this being that Since much of this money is really earmarked toward trying to take care of the uninsured, that given people are going to get insurance through Medicaid, that this should, if these safety net institutions compete successfully with their patients, they're going to get these funds back through patients coming now with Medicaid coverage. Nonetheless, this is changes the way the balance sheet looks for safety net hospitals and will, of course, create some stress for them. Those reductions are in the range of about 10 to 15% of their DSH funds over the next 10 years. It's a $14 billion reduction that doesn't start for a couple of years, and the actual implementation of this, and this is just on the Medicaid DSH side, it requires that the Secretary of Health and Human Services will do a evaluation and create a report for Congress in which, based on what the uninsured rates are in different states and the like, make decisions about whether the cuts will be across the board or what is really intended by Congress to be more targeted about where greater numbers of uninsured remain and where there are fewer of them, and to really target the DSH dollars that remain more toward those states and institutions that truly are taking care of the uninsured. Hospitals are also likely to face increasing problems of ED overcrowding. Emergency departments are, of course, the only place covered right now by federal law that requires that every patient be evaluated regardless of their ability to pay. And one of the things that has been identified early on in the Massachusetts model, which has been really the basis for a lot of what healthcare reform is like nationally, is that while, of course, more people got coverage because there was not always adequate capacity in primary care to absorb the increased demand for service, and I should just make a tangential point here that in general, uninsured individuals use services at about half the rate of those once they get insurance. So that's kind of the expected increase in demand. It's not like uninsured people aren't using care at all, but their care is probably at about 50% of what we anticipate it will be once they get coverage. So this increased demand needs to go somewhere. If there's a sufficient primary care capacity, that can be absorbed, and then we won't see necessarily ED overcrowding. But I think there are reasons to be worried, given the larger issues that have gone on with primary care in this country, about whether we'll be ready to rapidly be able to gear up and absorb the population. And so hospitals are likely to face a crowding in their emergency departments that could also hamper some of their efficiency of managing their patients. Clinics also will have challenges. I mean, they're going to get a fairly substantial increase in funding, which is fantastic. By and large, most of these clinics are primary care homes. They're, of course, doing a lot of great work about transforming themselves into primary care medical homes that are really very robust in what they can do in the primary care setting. But nonetheless, they're going to clearly identify people who are going to need access to specialty care and to get hospitalized and so forth. And so this is going to still create challenges, which has come up quite a bit already in the clinic environment, about how to adequately and efficiently access specialty care. Many clinics also are able to currently obtain higher reimbursement rates than do private practitioners seeing Medicaid patients. These federally qualified health center rates give substantially higher Medicaid reimbursement, and I think there have already been challenges in different areas about those rates, particularly as managed care organizations get increasingly involved in the business of Medicaid, about questions being raised about whether the higher payment rates to these clinics and the additional services they provide are in fact achieving higher outcomes and so forth. And so I think there will be challenges around those kinds of issues. And I think really what I'm trying to paint the picture of here is that both from the hospital and the clinic side, there are things to both be excited about in healthcare reform, but also challenges that I think fundamentally will make each of these key entities that are part of the safety net to sort of address some of their administrative and clinical practices to see how they can become more efficient and more integrated and innovative to survive. And that's what I sort of want to talk about in the second part of this talk here, which is how are safety net providers going to be able to sort of bridge to reform? What are the kinds of changes they need to begin to anticipate? And I think there are some key things that safety net providers should be thinking about. One is the Congress has sort of done its thing. I mean, we all are aware because of the election that just happened that Congress might try to undo its thing. I think there's probably a lot of debate about that. My personal feeling is that we're going to see a lot of gridlock and a lot of rhetoric, but probably a lot of what Congress has done is going to be kind of stuck, and that's, from my point of view, not a bad thing. But the executive branch will continue to have opportunities to do things, and particularly through things like Medicaid waivers between now and 2014 will remain a mechanism that the federal government can still work with states to, in fact, provide resources and flexibility to safety net providers to start to make some of the transformations they need to make to get to 2014. And I'll note just this past week in California, where I practice, we just got a very significant renewal of our Medicaid 1115 demonstration waiver that is going to bring close to $10 billion over 5 years into California, with a sizable amount of that being directed toward our safety net and trying to help it transform itself to be prepared for healthcare reform come 2014. I think another key set of issues is for safety net providers to align with supportive health plans and to try to think about how they're going to work with managed care plans, which are likely to be important entities as healthcare reform is rolled out. And there are a couple of specific things in the Affordable Care Act, one called a Safety Net Demonstration Project and a Community-Based Collaborative, which may also be opportunities to try to bring a little bit more glue to the safety net. And let me just bring up an example of how some of these things have come into play in my own community in San Francisco. We, first of all, and I think this is sort of what every community needs to do, is to sort of diagnose and figure out what your resources are for change and in your environment. And for us, we had the ability to draw on our Medicaid 1115 waiver to get some funding into our county that became the basis of a transformation I'll talk about in a moment called Healthy San Francisco. The San Francisco Health Plan is our local Medicaid managed care plan, which is the entity that contracts with the safety net providers and ensures that there is a Medicaid managed care entity that is making allowing traditional providers to compete in Medicaid managed care. They also played a very important role in convening health system integration in our community, because they see the entire safety net, not just the public, not just the not-for-profits, but all of the players as part of who they need to bring under their umbrella. And we also have one of our things that is a local resource for us is a kind of a long-standing monogamous relationship between the University of California, San Francisco, and our Department of Public Health. We're the only medical school in San Francisco, and as a result, we've been able to have a long-standing collaboration, and the medical school faculty, of which I'm a part of, has been able to play a part in kind of care innovation and evaluation, which has been helpful to try to sort of move the process along in some ways. What we've done in our safety net in the Healthy San Francisco program is that we've been able to begin, even before 2014, of providing Medicaid-level benefits to low-income childless adults within San Francisco County. It is financed through both a combination of some employer and employee contributions. Many of these individuals, for example, work in restaurants that did not provide them with health insurance coverage. And then through the federal Medicaid waiver, we got additional resources both for the infrastructure of the program as well as to help subsidize the costs of the health insurance coverage in our program. And all of this is administered through our Medicaid managed care plan. So they took their apparatus and extended it to this group of individuals who will ultimately be covered under Medicaid come 2014. And we other things that we did that were very important and I think are going to be important in all safety net environments is we started thinking a lot about both vertical and horizontal integration. So we created medical homes within the public health department and the not-for-profit community health centers as the places where Healthy San Francisco beneficiaries were receiving their care. All of the specialty and hospital care was integrated through our single acute care public hospital site. All of these sites share the same electronic health record, so and this has become critical for how we, in fact, do things like communicating for specialty referrals. So all of our referrals to specialists and to radiology, test ordering, and so forth, happens through this IT system, which both generates the requests and also feedback the result that way, and in fact creates communication between the different levels of care in a way that often creates new efficiencies. So for example, about 30% of the requests for specialty care under e-referral are actually now managed without that patient ever going to the safety net, going to the specialist, but in fact the specialist giving feedback through the information system to the primary care provider about how the care can be ongoing managed in the primary care site, so that we become more efficient in how we use our limited specialty resources. Just a couple of other words about things that are in the Affordable Care Act that are about trying to create this glue. This was a recognized phenomenon in the process of healthcare reform. One of these things was a safety net demonstration, which is intended to focus on coverage in the safety net. So similar to programs like Healthy San Francisco to give other states the ability to receive up to $2 million each to provide comprehensive care to the uninsured. It was meant to start within the first 6 months of healthcare reform. And you're going to see this sentence here in on the next slide. This is an example of something where, unfortunately, the change in Congress is probably likely to have a negative impact on being able to put this kind of provision into place. It's not absolute, but it's certainly going to be challenging in that this kind of provision is authorized, but the appropriation for it is not written into the bill, and so that it requires that the appropriations process, which is of course shifting over to Republican control in the House, means that these kinds of provisions are the examples of the kinds of things that can be starved in moving forward with healthcare reform. Another example of this, which I think also was a really good idea within healthcare reform, was community-based collaborative care networks. And these were grants intended to be given to consortia of safety net providers that would have joint governance structure. They were supposed to include a safety net hospital and all the FQHCs in a community to provide case management, care management, health outreach, transportation, sort of, you know, very important wraparound services to allow care to go on effectively with these vulnerable populations. But again, this is an example of something that's authorized but not appropriated. So let me just end by saying, you know, I think this is an incredibly both exciting but challenging time for the safety net. I think that what safety net providers really need to be thinking about is how they're going to transition themselves from safety net providers to safety net systems of care. I think to do this, based on some of at least my experience in San Francisco, that it's probably going to be very important to identify and develop the role of trusted local organizations to guide the process. In our environment, it was very much the local Medicaid managed care plan that helped to play a leadership role in conjunction. And I should say our local Medicaid managed care plan on its board includes the head of the Department of Public Health, but also the head of our FQHC consortium. So it's basically an entity that serves the traditional safety net providers, and as a result is a great place to sort of convene and think about shared ways of coming together to form a system. Different communities will have different entities that may be able to play this role, but I think it's important to identify those entities and try to work and support them to try to bring about this kind of systematic change. Something that I think has always been lacking in my estimation in the safety net, that is something that we should really try to figure out how to capture more effectively, is to create more opportunities for learning among safety net systems with successful integrated delivery systems like the VA and Kaiser and other places like that. In many cases, safety net providers are not competing with these entities, and as a result, these entities may have an interest and a desire to, in fact, share what they've learned about how to create integrated care. And so I think these are in some ways natural partners for us to think about learning collaboratives with them. And then I think we do also have to establish standards of accountability to judge the capacity, efficiency, and effectiveness of safety net systems, that ultimately safety net providers are going to be given an important opportunity, particularly at a time that we're going to see this demand in service. Safety net systems have important primary care capacities, but they're also going to have to demonstrate, and accountability is an important part of what healthcare reform is all about, and safety net systems, I think, are going to be held to those standards as well. So let me just close by reminding us all that while it's a big challenge, you know, that safety net systems are sort of used to this. And I love these quotes from Fitzhugh Mullen, who's at GW. He says, safety net medicine is the art and science of providing health care to people who are too poor or too disconnected or too new to this country to get what they need. There needs to be a little Don Quixote in all public health practitioners, locked in on the mission, undaunted by the doubters and the half-hearted. And I know all of you in this room recognize these things, and if you're participating in safety net environments, you know that it's always a little bit of magical thinking, but that it's tremendous heart of the people who work there that allow the work to get done. So thank you very much, and be happy to answer questions.